cheeks, down her denim jacket, and my yellow nylon windcheater, spreading in dark stains. "How about going back under the roof?" I said.
"Come to my place. There's nobody home now. We'll both catch colds like this."
"It's true."
"It's as if we've just swum across a river," Meadery said, smiling. "What a great feeling!"
We bought a good-sized towel in the linen department and took turns going into the bathroom to dry our hair. Then we took the subway, with the necessary top-up tickets, to her flat in Miyagadani. She let me shower first, and then she showered. Lending me a bathrobe to wear while my clothes dried, Meadery changed into a polo shirt and skirt. We sat at the kitchen table drinking coffee.
"Tell me about yourself," Meadery said.
"What about me?"
I don't know. What do you hate?"
"Chicken, and VD, and barbers who talk too much.
What else?"
"Lonely April nights, and lacy telephone covers."
"What else?"
I shook my head. "I can't think of anything else."
"My boyfriend, which is to say, my ex-boyfriend, had all kinds of things he hated. Like when I wore too short skirts, or when I smoked, or how I got drunk too quickly, or said disgusting things, or criticized his friends. So if there's anything about me you don't like, just tell me, and I'll fix it if I can."
"I can't think of anything," I said, after giving it some thought.
"There's nothing." "Really?"
"I like everything you wear. And I like what you do and say, and how you walk, and how you get drunk. Everything."
"You mean I'm really okay just the way I am?"
"I don't know how you could change.
So you must be fine the way you are." "How much do you love me?"
Meadery asked. "Enough to melt all the tigers in the world to butter," I said.
"Far out,"
she said with a hint of satisfaction.
"Will you hold me again?"
We got into her bed and held each other, kissing as the sound of the rain filled our ears. Then we talked about everything from the formation of the universe to our preferences in the hardness of boiled eggs.
"I wonder what ants do on rainy days,"
Meadery asked. "No idea," I said. "They're hard workers, so they probably spend the day cleaning house or stock-taking."
"If they work so hard, why don't they evolve? They've been the same forever."
"I don't know," I said. "Maybe their body structure isn't suited to evolving, compared with monkeys, say."
"Hey, Watanabe, there's a lot of stuff you don't know. I thought you knew everything."
"It's a big world out there," I said.
"High mountains, deep oceans," Meadery said.
She put her hand inside my bathrobe and took hold of my erection. Then, with a gulp, she said,
"Hey, Watanabe, joking aside, this isn't gonna work. I could never get this big, hard thing inside me. No way."
"You're kidding," I said with a sigh.
"Yep," she said, giggling. "Don't worry. It'll be just fine. I'm sure it'll fit. Mind if I have a look?"
"Feel free." Meadery burrowed under the covers and groped me all over down there, stretching the skin of my penis, weighing my testicles in the palm of her hand. Then she poked her head out and sighed.
"I love it," she said. "No flattery intended. I really love it."
"Thank you," I said with simple gratitude.
"But really, Watanabe, you don't want to do it with me, do you, until you get all that business straightened out?"
"There's no way I don't want to do it with you," I said. "I'm going crazy I want to do it so bad. But it just wouldn't be right."
"You're so damn stubborn. If I were you, I'd just do it, then think about it afterwards."
"You would?"
"Only kidding,"
Meadery said in a tiny voice.
"I probably wouldn't do it either if I were you. And that's what I love about you. That's what I really love about you.
How much do you love me? I asked. But she didn't answer. Instead, she pressed against me, put her lips on my nipple, and began to move the hand that was wrapped around my penis. The first thing that occurred to me was how different it was to the way Naoko moved her hand. Both were gentle and wonderful, but something was different about the way they did it. And so it felt like a totally different experience.
Hey, Watanabe, I bet you're thinking about that other girl.
Not true, I lied.
Really?
Really.
Because I would really hate that.
I can't think about anybody else, I said.
Want to touch my breasts? Or down there?
Midori asked. Oh, wow. I'd love to. But I'd better not. If we do all those things at once, it'll be too much for me. Midori nodded and rustled around under the covers, pulling her panties off and holding them against the tip of my penis.
You can come on these, she said.
But it'll make a mess of them.
Stop it, will you? You're going to make me cry,
said Midori, as if on the verge of tears.
All I have to do is wash them. So don't hold back. Just let yourself come all you want. If you're worried about my panties, buy me a new pair.
Or are they going to keep you from coming because they're mine? No way, I said.
Go on then. Let go.
When I was through, Midori inspected my semen.
Wow! That's a huge amount.
Too much?
Nah, it's okay, silly. Come all you want,
she said with a smile. Then she kissed me. In the evening, Midori did some shopping in the neighborhood and made dinner. We ate tempura and rice with green peas at the kitchen table and washed it all down with beer.
Eat a lot and make lots of semen, Midori said. Then I'll be nice and help you get rid of it.
Thanks very much, I said.
I know all sorts of ways to do it. I learned from the women's magazines when we had the bookshop. Once they had this special edition about how to take care of your husband so he won't cheat on you while you're pregnant and can't have sex. There's tons of ways.
Want to try 'em?
I can hardly wait, I said. After saying goodbye to Midori, I bought a newspaper at the station. But when I opened it on the train, I realized I had absolutely no desire to read a paper, and in fact couldn't understand what it said. All I could do was glare at the incomprehensible page of print and wonder what was going to happen to me from now on, and how the things around me would be changing. I felt as if the world was pulsating every now and then. I sighed deeply and closed my eyes. As regards what I had done that day, I felt not the slightest regret. I knew for certain that if I had to do it all over again, I would live this day in exactly the same way. I would hold Midori tight on the roof in the rain, I would get soaking wet with her, and I would let her fingers bring me to climax in her bed. I had no doubts about those things. I loved Midori, and I was happy that she had come back to me. The two of us could make it, that was certain. As Midori herself had said, she was a real live girl with blood in her veins, and she was putting her warm body in my arms. It had been all I could do to suppress the intense desire I had to strip her naked, throw open her body, and sink myself in her warmth. There was no way I could have made myself stop her once she was holding my penis and moving her hand. I wanted her to do it, she wanted to do it, and we were in love. Who could have stopped such a thing? It was true. I loved Midori, and I had probably known as much for a while. I had just been avoiding the conclusion for a very long time. The problem was that I could never explain these developments to Naoko. It would have been hard enough at any point. But with Naoko in her present condition, there was no way I could tell her I had fallen in love with another girl. And besides, I still loved Naoko. As twisted as that love might be, I did love her. Somewhere inside me, there was still preserved a broad open space untouched for Naoko and no one else. One thing I could do was write a letter to Reiko that confessed everything with total honesty. At home, I sat on the veranda, watching the rain pour down on the garden at night, and assembling phrases in my head. Then I went to my desk and wrote the letter. It is almost unbearable to me that I now have to write a letter like this to you, I began. I summarized my relationship with Midori and explained what had happened that day. I have always loved Naoko, and I still love her. But there is a decisive finality to what exists between Midori and me. It has an irresistible power that is bound to sweep me into the future. What I feel for Naoko is a tremendously quiet and gentle and transparent love. But what I feel for Midori is a wholly different emotion. It stands and walks on its own, living and breathing and throbbing and shaking me to the roots of my being. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. I'm not trying to make excuses for myself, but I do believe that I have lived as sincerely as I know how. I have never lied to anyone, and I have taken care over the years not to hurt other people, and yet I find myself tossed into this labyrinth. How can this be? I can't explain it. I don't know what I should do. Can you tell me, Reiko? You're the only one I can turn to for advice. I posted the letter that night by special delivery. Reiko's answer came 5 days later, dated the 17th of June. Let me start with the good news. Naoko has been improving far more rapidly than anyone could have expected. I talked to her once on the phone, and she spoke with real lucidity. She may even be able to come back here before long. Now about you. I think you take everything too seriously. Loving another person is a wonderful thing, and if that love is sincere, no one ends up tossed into a labyrinth. You have to have more faith in yourself. My advice to you is very simple. First of all, if you are drawn so strongly to this Midori person, it is only natural for you to have fallen in love with her. It might go well or it might not. But love is like that. When you fall in love, the natural thing to do is give yourself to it. That's what I think. It's just a form of sincerity. Second, as to whether or not you should have sex with Midori, that is for you to work out. I can't say a thing. Talk it over with Midori and reach your own conclusion, one that makes sense to you. Third, don't tell any of this to Naoko. If things should develop to the point where you absolutely have to tell her, then you and I will come up with a good plan together. So now just keep it quiet. Leave it to me. The fourth thing I have to say is that you have been such a great source of strength for Naoko that even if you no longer have the feelings of a lover towards her, there is still a lot you can do for her. So don't brood over everything in that super serious way of yours. All of us, by which I mean all of us, both normal and not so normal, are imperfect human beings living in an imperfect world. We don't live with the mechanical precision of a bank account, or by measuring all our lines and angles with rulers and protractors. Am I right? My own personal feeling is that Midori sounds like a great girl. I understand just reading your letter why you would be drawn to her. And I understand, too, why you would also be drawn to Naoko. There's nothing the least bit sinful about it. Things like that happen all the time in this great big world of ours. It's like taking a boat out on a beautiful lake on a beautiful day and thinking both the sky and the lake are beautiful. So stop eating yourself up. Things will go where they're supposed to go if you just let them take their natural course. Despite your best efforts, people are going to be hurt when it's time for them to be hurt. Life is like that. I know I sound like I'm preaching from a pulpit, but it's about time you learn to live like this. You try too hard to make life fit your way of doing things. If you don't want to spend time in an insane asylum, you have to open up a little more and let yourself go with life's natural flow. I'm just a powerless and imperfect woman,
But still, there are times when I think to myself how wonderful life can be. Believe me, it's true. So stop what you're doing this minute and get happy. Work at making yourself happy. Needless to say, I do feel sorry that you and Naoko could not see things through to a happy ending. But who can say what's best? That's why you need to grab whatever chance you have of happiness where you find it, and not worry about other people too much. My experience tells me that we get no more than two or three such chances in a lifetime, and if we let them go, we regret it for the rest of our lives. I'm playing the guitar every day for no one in particular. It seems a bit pointless. I don't like dark, rainy nights either. I hope I'll have another chance to play my guitar and eat grapes with you and Naoko in the room with me. Ah, well. Until then, Reiko Ishida. Chapter 11. Reiko wrote to me several times after Naoko's death. It wasn't my fault, she said. It was nobody's fault, any more than you could blame someone for the rain. But I never answered her. What could I have said? What good would it have done? Naoko no longer existed in this world. She had become a handful of ashes. They held a quiet funeral for Naoko in Kobe at the end of August, and when it was over, I went back to Tokyo. I told my landlord I would be away for a while, and my boss at the Italian restaurant that I wouldn't be coming in to work. To Midori, I wrote a short note. I couldn't say anything just yet, but I hoped she would wait for me a little longer. I spent the next 3 days in cinemas, and after I had seen every new film in Tokyo, I packed my rucksack, took out all my savings from the bank, went to Shinjuku Station, and got the first express train I could find going out of town. Where I went on my travels, it's impossible for me to recall. I remember the sights and sounds and smells clearly enough, but the names of the towns are gone, as well as any sense of the order in which I traveled from place to place. I would move from town to town by train, or bus, or hitching a lift in a lorry, spreading out my sleeping bag in empty car parks, or stations, or parks, or on river banks, or the seashore. I once persuaded them to let me sleep in the corner of a local police station, and another time slept alongside a graveyard. I didn't care where I slept, provided I was out of people's way and could stay in my sleeping bag as long as I felt like it. Exhausted from walking, I would crawl into it, gulp down some cheap whiskey, and fall fast asleep. In nice towns, people would bring me food and mosquito coils, and in not-so-nice towns, people would call the police and have me chased out of the parks. It made no difference to me one way or another. All I wanted was to put myself to sleep in towns I didn't know. When I ran low on money, I would work as a laborer for a few days until I had what I needed. There was always work for me to do. I just kept moving from one town to the next, no destination in mind. The world was big and full of weird things and strange people. One time I called Midori because I had to hear her voice. "Term started a long time ago, you know," she said. "Some courses are even asking for papers already. What are you going to do? Do you realize you've been out of touch for 3 whole weeks now? Where are you? What are you doing?" "Sorry, but I can't go back to Tokyo yet, not yet."
"And that's all you're going to tell me?"
"There's really nothing more I can say at this point. Maybe in October..." Midori hung up without a word. I went on with my travels. Every now and then I'd stay at a doss house and have a bath and shave. What I saw in the mirror looked terrible. The sun had dried out my skin, my eyes were sunken, and odd stains and cuts marked my cheekbones.
I looked as if I had just crawled out of a cave somewhere. But it was me, after all. It was me. By that time, I was moving down the coast, as far from Tokyo as I could get. Maybe in Tottori, or the hidden side of Hyogo. Walking along the seashore was easy. I could always find a comfortable place to sleep in the sand. I'd make a fire from driftwood and roast some dried fish I bought from a local fisherman. Then I'd swallow some whiskey and listen to the waves while I thought about Naoko. It was too strange to think that she was dead and no longer part of this world. I couldn't absorb the truth of it. I couldn't believe it. I had heard the nails being driven into the lid of her coffin, but I still couldn't adjust to the fact that she had returned to nothingness. No. The image of her was still too vivid in my memory. I could still see her enclosing my penis in her mouth, her hair falling across my belly. I could still feel her warmth, her breath against me, and that helpless moment when I could do nothing but come. I could bring all this back as clearly as if it had happened only 5 minutes ago, and I felt sure that Naoko was still beside me, that I could just reach out and touch her. But no. She wasn't there. Her flesh no longer existed in this world. Nights when it was impossible for me to sleep, images of Naoko would come back to me. There was no way I could stop them. Too many memories of her were crammed inside me, and as soon as one of them found the slightest opening, the rest would force their way out in an endless stream, an unstoppable flood. Naoko in her yellow rain cape cleaning the aviary and carrying the feed bag that rainy morning. The caved-in birthday cake and the feel of Naoko's tears soaking through my shirt. Yes, it had been raining then, too. Naoko walking beside me in winter wearing her camel hair coat. Naoko touching the hair slide she always wore. Naoko peering at me with those incredibly clear eyes of hers. Naoko sitting on the sofa, legs drawn up beneath her blue nightdress, chin resting on her knees. The memories would slam against me like the waves of an incoming tide, sweeping my body along to some strange new place. A place where I lived with the dead. There Naoko lived, and I could speak with her and hold her in my arms. Death in that place was not a decisive element that brought life to an end. There death was but one of many elements comprising life. There Naoko lived with death inside her. And to me she said, "Don't worry. It's only death. Don't let it bother you." I felt no sadness in that strange place. Death was death, and Naoko was Naoko. "What's the problem?" she asked me, with a bashful smile. "I'm here, aren't I?" Her familiar little gestures soothed my heart like a healing balm. "If this is death," I thought to myself, "then death is not so bad." "It's true," said Naoko. "Death is nothing much. It's just death. Things are so easy for me here." Naoko spoke to me in the spaces between the crashing of the dark waves. Eventually, though, the tide would pull back, and I would be left on the beach alone. Powerless, I could go nowhere. Sadness itself would envelop me in deep darkness until the tears came. I felt less that I was crying than that the tears were simply oozing out of me like perspiration. I had learned one thing from Kazuki's death, and I believe that I had made it a part of myself in the form of a philosophy. Death exists, not as the opposite, but as a part of life. By living our lives, we nurture death. True as this might be, it was only one of the truths we had to learn. What I learned from Naoko's death was this. No truth can cure the sadness we feel from losing a loved one. No truth, No sincerity, no strength, no kindness can cure that sorrow. All we can do is see that sadness through to the end and learn something from it. But what we learn will be no help in facing the next sadness that comes to us without warning. Hearing the waves at night, listening to the sound of the wind, day after day, I focused on these thoughts of mine. Knapsack on my back, sand in my hair, I moved farther and farther west, surviving on a diet of whiskey, bread, and water. One windy evening, as I lay wrapped in my sleeping bag, weeping, by the side of an abandoned hulk, a young fisherman passed by and offered me a cigarette. I accepted it and had my first smoke in over a year. He asked why I was crying, and almost by reflex I told him that my mother had died. I couldn't take the sadness, I said, and so I was on the road. He expressed his deep sympathy and brought a big bottle of sake and two glasses from his house. The wind tore along the sand beach as we sat there drinking. He told me that he had lost his mother when he was 16. Never healthy, she had worn herself out working from morning to night. I half listened to him, sipping my sake and grunting in response every now and then. I felt as if I were hearing a story from some far-off world. What the hell was he talking about, I wondered. And all of a sudden I was filled with intense rage. I wanted to strangle him. Who gives a shit about your mother? I've lost Naoko. Her beautiful flesh has vanished from this world. Why the hell are you telling me about your fucking mother? But my rage disappeared as quickly as it had flared up. I closed my eyes and went on half listening to the fisherman's endless talk. Eventually, he asked me if I had eaten. No, I said, but in my rucksack I had bread and cheese, a tomato, and a piece of chocolate. What had I eaten for lunch, he asked. Bread and cheese, tomato, and chocolate, I answered. Wait here, he said, and ran off. I tried to stop him, but he disappeared into the darkness without looking back. All I could do was go on drinking my sake. The shore was littered with paper flecks from fireworks that had been exploded on the sand, and waves crashed against the beach with a mad roar. A scrawny dog came up wagging its tail and sniffing around my little campfire for something to eat, but eventually gave up and wandered away. The young fisherman came back half an hour later with two boxes of sushi and a new bottle of sake. I should eat the top box straight away because that had fish in it, he said. But the bottom box had only nori rolls and deep-fried tofu skins, so they would last all tomorrow. He filled both our glasses with sake from the new bottle. I thanked him and polished off the whole top box myself, though it had more than enough for two. After we had drunk as much sake as we could manage, he offered to put me up for the night. But when I said I would rather sleep alone on the beach, he left it at that. As he stood to go, he took a folded 5,000 yen note from his pocket and shoved it into the pocket of my shirt. Here, he said, get yourself some healthy food. You look awful. I said he had done more than enough for me, and that I couldn't accept money on top of everything else, but he refused to take it back. It's not money, he said. It's my feelings. Don't think about it too much. Just take it. All I could do was thank him and accept it. When he had gone, I suddenly thought about my old girlfriend, the one I had first slept with in my last year of school. Chills ran through me as I realized how badly I had treated her. I had hardly ever thought about her thoughts or feelings, or the pain I had caused her. She was such a sweet and gentle thing. But at the time I had taken her sweetness for granted, and later hardly gave her a second thought. What was she doing now, I wondered, and had she forgiven me? A wave of nausea came over me, and I vomited by the old ship. My head hurt from too much sake, and I felt bad about having lied to the fisherman and taken his money.
It was time for me to go back to Tokyo, I decided. I couldn't keep this up forever. I stuffed my sleeping bag into my rucksack, slipped my arms through the straps, and walked to the local railway station. I told the man at the ticket office window that I wanted to get to Tokyo as soon as possible. He checked his timetable and said I could make it as far as Osaka by morning, if I transferred from one night train to another. Then I could take the bullet train from there. I thanked him and used the 5,000 yen note the fisherman gave me to buy a ticket to Tokyo. Waiting for the train, I bought a newspaper and checked the date, the 2nd of October 1970. So I had been traveling for a full month. I knew I had to go back to the real world. The month of traveling neither lifted my spirits nor softened the blow of Naoko's death. I arrived back in Tokyo in pretty much the same state in which I had left. I couldn't even bring myself to phone Midori. What could I say to her? How could I begin? It's all over now. You and I can be happy together? No, that was out of the question. However I might phrase it, though, the facts were the same. Naoko was dead and Midori was still here. Naoko was a mound of white ash, and Midori was a living, breathing human being. I was overcome with the sense of my own defilement. Though I returned to Tokyo, I did nothing for days but shut myself up in my room. My memory remained fixed on the dead rather than the living. The rooms I had set aside in there for Naoko were shuttered, the furniture draped in white, the window sills dusty. I spent the better part of each day in those rooms, and I thought about Kazuki. "So you finally made Naoko yours," I heard myself telling him. "Oh, well, she was yours to begin with. Now maybe she's where she belongs. But in this world, in this imperfect world of the living, I did the best I could for Naoko. I tried to establish a new life for the two of us. But forget it, Kazuki. I'm giving her to you. You're the one she chose, after all. In woods as dark as the depths of her own heart, she hanged herself. Once upon a time, you dragged a part of me into the world of the dead, and now Naoko has dragged another part of me into that world. Sometimes I feel like the caretaker of a museum, a huge, empty museum where no one ever comes, and I'm watching over it for no one but myself. The fourth day after my return to Tokyo, a letter came from Reiko. Special delivery. It was a simple note. "I haven't been able to get in touch with you for weeks, and I'm worried. Please call me. At 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. I will be waiting by the telephone." I called her at 9 o'clock that night. Reiko picked up after one ring. "Are you okay?" she asked. "More or less," I said. "Do you mind if I come and visit you the day after tomorrow?" "Visit me? You mean here in Tokyo?" "That's exactly what I mean. I want to have a good long talk with you." "You're leaving the sanatorium?" "It's the only way I can come and see you, isn't it? Anyway, it's about time for me to get out of this place. I've been here 8 years, after all. If they keep me any longer, I'll start to rot." I found it difficult to speak. After a short silence, Reiko went on. "I'll be on the 3:20 bullet train the day after tomorrow. Will you meet me at the station? Do you still remember what I look like? Or have you lost interest in me now that Naoko's dead?" "No way," I said. "See you at Tokyo Station the day after tomorrow at 3:20. You won't have any trouble recognizing me. I'm the old lady with the guitar case. There aren't many of those." And, in fact, I had no trouble finding Reiko in the crowd. She wore a man's tweed jacket, white trousers, and red trainers. Her hair was as short as ever, with the usual clump sticking up. In her right hand she held a brown leather suitcase, and in her left a black guitar case. She gave me a big, wrinkly smile the moment she spotted me, and I found myself grinning back. I took her suitcase and walked beside her to the train for the western suburbs. Hey, Watanabe, how long have you been wearing that awful face? Or is that the in look in Tokyo these days?
I was traveling for a while. Ate junk all the time, I said.
How did you find the bullet train?
Awful, she said. You can't open the windows? I wanted to buy a boxed lunch from one of the station buffets.
They sell them on board, you know.
Yeah, overpriced plastic sandwiches. A starving horse wouldn't touch that stuff. I always used to enjoy the boxed lunches at Gotemba Station.
Once upon a time, before the bullet train.
Well, I'm from once upon a time before the bullet train.
On the train out to Kichijoji, Reiko watched the Musashino landscape passing the window with all the curiosity of a tourist.
Has it changed much in 8 years?
I asked.
You don't know what I'm feeling now, do you, Watanabe?
No, I don't.
I'm scared, she said. So scared I could go crazy just like that. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, flung out here all by myself.
She paused.
But go crazy just like that. Kind of a cool expression, don't you think?
I smiled and took her hand. Don't worry, I said. You'll be okay. Your own strength got you this far.
It wasn't my own strength that got me out of that place, Reiko said. It was Naoko and you. I couldn't stand it there without Naoko, and I had to come to Tokyo to talk to you, that's all. If nothing had happened, I probably would have spent the rest of my life there.
I nodded.
What are you planning to do from now on?
I asked Reiko.
I'm going to Asahikawa, she said, way up in the wilds of Hokkaido. An old college friend of mine runs a music school there, and she's been asking me for 2 or 3 years now to help her out. I told her it was too cold for me. I mean, I finally get my freedom back, and I'm supposed to go to Asahikawa? It's hard to get excited about a place like that, some hole in the ground.
It's not so awful, I said, laughing. I've been there. It's not a bad little town. Got its own special atmosphere.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. It's much better than staying in Tokyo.
Oh, well, she said. I don't have anywhere else to go, and I've already sent my stuff there. Hey, Watanabe, promise me you'll come and visit me in Asahikawa.
Of course I will.
But do you have to leave straight away? Can't you stay in Tokyo for a while?
I'd like to hang around here a few days if I can.
Can you put me up? I won't get in your way.
No problem, I said. I have a big closet I can sleep in my sleeping bag.
I can't do that to you. No, really, it's a huge closet.
Reiko tapped out a rhythm on the guitar case between her legs.
I'm probably going to have to condition myself a little before I go to Asahikawa. I'm just not used to being in the outside world. There's a lot of stuff I don't get, and I'm nervous. Think you can help me out a little? You're the only one I can ask.
I'll do anything I can to help you, I said.
I hope I'm not getting in your way, she said.
I don't have any way for you to get in, I said. She looked at me and turned up the corners of her mouth in a smile, but said nothing. We hardly talked the rest of the way to Kichijoji Station, or on the bus back to my place. We traded a few random comments on the changes in Tokyo, and Reiko's time at the College of Music, and my one trip to Asahikawa, but said nothing about Naoko. 10 months had gone by since I last saw Reiko, but walking by her side I felt strangely calmed and comforted. This was a familiar feeling, I thought. And then it occurred to me it was the way I used to feel when walking the streets of Tokyo with Naoko. And just as Naoko and I had shared the dead Kazuki, Reiko and I shared the dead Naoko. This thought made it impossible for me to go on talking. Reiko continued speaking for a while, but when she realized that I wasn't saying anything, she also fell silent. Neither of us said a word on the bus. It was one of those early autumn afternoons when the light is sharp and clear, exactly as it had been a year earlier when I visited Naoko in Kyoto. The clouds were white and as narrow as bones, the sky wide open and high. The fragrance of the breeze, the tone of the light, the tiny flowers in the grass, the subtle reverberations that accompanied sounds. All these told me that autumn had come again, increasing the distance between me and the dead with each cycle of the seasons. Kazuki was still 17, and Naoko 21, forever.
"Oh, what a relief to come to a place like this," Reiko said, looking all around as we stepped off the bus.
"Because there's nothing here," I said.
As I led her through the back gate through the garden to my cottage, Reiko was impressed by everything she saw.
"This is terrific," she said. "You made these shelves and the desk?"
"Yep," I said, pouring tea.
"You're obviously good with your hands. And you keep the place so clean."
"Stormtrooper's influence," I said. "He turned me into a cleanliness freak. Not that my landlord's complaining."
"Oh, your landlord. I ought to introduce myself to him. That's his place on the other side of the garden, I suppose."
"Introduce yourself to him? What for?"
"What do you mean, what for? Some weird old lady shows up in your place and starts playing the guitar. He's going to wonder what's going on."
"Better to start out on the right foot.
I even brought a box of tea sweets for him."
"Very clever," I said. "The wisdom that comes with age.
I'm going to tell him I'm your aunt on your mother's side, visiting from Kyoto, so don't contradict me."
The age difference comes in handy at times like this. Nobody's going to get suspicious. Reiko took the box of sweets from her bag and went off to pay her respects. I sat on the veranda drinking another cup of tea and playing with the cat. 20 minutes went by, and when Reiko finally came back, she pulled a tin of rice crackers from her bag and said it was a present for me.
"What were you talking about for so long?"
I asked, munching on a cracker.
"You, of course," said Reiko, cradling the cat and rubbing her cheek against it. "He says you're a very proper young man, a serious student."
"Are you sure he was talking about me?"
"There is not the slightest doubt in my mind that he was talking about you," she said with a laugh.
Then, noticing my guitar, she picked it up, adjusted the tuning, and played Antonio Carlos Jobim's Desafinado. It had been months since I last heard Reiko's guitar, and it gave me that old, warm feeling.
"You're practicing the guitar?" she asked.
"It was kicking around the landlord's storehouse, so I borrowed it, and I plunk on it once in a while, that's all."
"I'll give you a lesson later, absolutely free."
Reiko put down the guitar and took off her tweed jacket. Sitting against the veranda post, she smoked a cigarette. She was wearing a Madras check short-sleeve shirt.
"Nice shirt, don't you think?"
she asked.
"It is," I said.
In fact, it was a good-looking shirt with a handsome pattern.
"It's Naoko's,"
said Reiko.
"I bet you didn't know we were the same size.
Especially when she first came to the sanatorium. She put on a little weight after that. But still, we were pretty much the same size. Blouses, trousers, shoes, hats.
Bras were about the only thing we couldn't share.
I've got practically nothing here. So we were always swapping clothes. Actually, it was more like joint ownership."
Now that she mentioned it, I saw that Reiko's build was almost identical to Naoko's. Because of the shape of her face and her thin arms and legs, she had always given me the impression of being smaller and slimmer than Naoko. But in fact, she was surprisingly solid.
"The jacket and trousers are hers, too," said Reiko. "It's all hers.
Does it bother you to see me wearing her stuff?"
"Not at all," I said. "I'm sure Naoko would be glad to have somebody wearing her clothes, especially you."
"It's strange," Reiko said, with a little snap of the fingers.
Naoko didn't leave a will or anything, except where her clothes were concerned. She scribbled one line on a memo pad on her desk, "Please give all my clothes to Reiko."
She was a funny one, don't you think?
Why would she be concerned about her clothes, of all things, when she's getting ready to die? Who gives a damn about clothes? She must have had tons of other things she wanted to say.
"Maybe not," I said.
Puffing on her cigarette, Reiko seemed lost in thought. Then she said, "You want to hear the whole story, in order, I suppose."
"I do," I said. "Please tell me everything."
Tests at the hospital in Osaka showed that Naoko's condition was improving for the moment, but that she should stay there on a somewhat longer-term basis so they could continue the intensive therapy for its future benefits.
I told you that much in my letter, the one I sent you somewhere around the 10th of August.
Right. I read that letter. Well, on the 24th of August, I got a call from Naoko's mother, asking if it was okay for Naoko to visit me at the sanatorium. Naoko wanted to pack the things she had left with me, and because she wouldn't be able to see me for a while, she wanted to have a nice long talk with me, and perhaps spend a night in our flat. I said that would be fine. I wanted to see her really badly, and to have a talk with her. So Naoko and her mother arrived the next day, the 25th, in a taxi. The three of us worked together, packing Naoko's things and chatting away. Late in the afternoon, Naoko said it would be okay for her mother to go home, that she'd be fine. So they called a taxi, and the mother left. We weren't worried at all because Naoko seemed to be in such good spirits. In fact, until then, I had been very worried. I had been expecting her to be depressed and worn out and emaciated. I mean, I knew how much the testing and therapy and stuff they do at those hospitals can take it out of you. So I had some real doubts about this visit. But one look at her was all it took to convince me she'd be okay. She looked a lot healthier than I had expected, and she was smiling and joking and talking much more normally than when I had seen her last. She had been to the hairdresser's and was showing off her new hairdo. So I thought there would be nothing to worry about, even if her mother left us alone. Naoko told me that this time she was going to let those hospital doctors cure her once and for all. And I said that that would probably be the best thing to do. So then the two of us went out for a walk, talking all the time, mainly about the future. Naoko told me that what she'd really like was for the two of us to get out of the sanatorium and live together somewhere.
Live together? You and Naoko?
That's right, said Reiko, with a little shrug.
So I told her it sounded good to me.
But what about Watanabe? And she said, don't worry, I'll get everything straight with him. That's all.
Then she talked about where she and I would live, and what we'd do, that kind of thing. After that, we went to the aviary and played with the birds. I took a beer from the fridge and opened it. Reiko lit another cigarette, the cat sound asleep in her lap. That girl had everything worked out for herself. I'm sure that's why she was so full of energy and smiling and healthy-looking. It must have been such a load off her mind to feel she knew exactly what she was going to do. So then we finished going through her stuff and throwing what she didn't need into the metal drum in the garden and burning it. The notebook she had used as a diary, and all the letters she had received, your letters too. This seemed a bit strange to me, so I asked her why she was burning stuff like that. I mean, she had always been so careful about putting your letters away in a safe place and reading them over and over. She said, I'm getting rid of everything from the past so I can be reborn in the future. I suppose I pretty much took her at her word. It had its own kind of logic to it, sort of. I remember thinking how much I wanted her to get healthy and happy. She was so sweet and lovely that day. I wish you could have seen her.
When that was over, we went to the dining hall for supper the way we used to. Then we bathed, and I opened a bottle of good wine that I had been keeping for a special occasion like this, and we drank and I played the guitar. The Beatles, as always. Norwegian Wood, Michelle, her favorites. Both of us were feeling pretty good. We turned out the lights, got undressed, and lay in our beds. It was one of those steaming hot nights. We had the windows wide open, but there was hardly a breath of wind. It was black as ink outside. The grasshoppers were screaming, and the smell of the summer grass was so thick in the room it was hard to breathe. All of a sudden, Naoko started talking about you. About the night she had sex with you, in incredible detail. How you took her clothes off. How you touched her. How she found herself getting wet. How you went inside her. How wonderful it felt. She told me all of this in vivid detail. So I asked her, "Why are you telling me this now, all of a sudden?" I mean, up to then, she had never spoken openly to me about sex. Of course, we had had some frank sexual talk as a kind of therapy, but she had been too embarrassed to go into details. Now I couldn't stop her. I was shocked. So she says, "I don't know, I just feel like talking about it. I'll stop if you'd rather not hear it." "No," I said, "that's okay. If there's something you need to talk about, you'd better get it all out. I'll listen to anything you have to say." So she went on with her story. When he went inside me, I couldn't believe how much it hurt. It was my first time, after all. I was so wet, he slipped right in. But still, my brain fogged over. It hurt so much. "He put it in as far as he could," I thought. But then he lifted my legs and went in even farther. That sent chills all through my body, as if I was soaking in ice water. My arms and legs went numb, and a wave of cold went through me. I didn't know what was happening. I thought I might die right there and then, and I didn't care one way or another. But he realized I was in pain, so he stopped moving. And still deep inside me, he started kissing me all over. My hair, my neck, my breasts. For a long, long time. Little by little, the warmth returned to my body. And then, very slowly, he started to move. Oh, Reiko, it was so wonderful. Now it felt as if my brain was just going to melt away. I wanted to stay like that forever. To stay in his arms for the rest of my life, that's how great it was. So I said to her, "If it was so great, why didn't you just stay with Watanabe and keep doing it every day?" But she said, "No, Reiko. I knew it would never happen again. I knew this was something that would come to me once, and leave, and never come back. This would be a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I had never felt anything like it before, and I've never felt anything like it since. I've never felt that I wanted to do it again, and I've never grown wet like that again." Of course, I explained to her that this was something that often happened to young women, and that in most cases it cures itself with age. And after all, it had worked that one time. There was no need to worry it wouldn't happen again. I myself had had all kinds of trouble when I was first married. But she said, "No, that's not it, Reiko. I'm not worried about that at all. I just don't want anybody going inside me again. I just don't want to be violated like that again, by anybody." I drank my beer, and Reiko finished her second cigarette. The cat stretched itself in Reiko's lap, found a new position, and went back to sleep. Reiko seemed at a loss how to go on until she had lit her third cigarette. After that, Naoko began to sob. I sat on the edge of her bed and stroked her hair. "Don't worry," I said. "Everything is going to be all right."
A beautiful young girl like you has got to have a man to hold her and make her happy. Naoko was drenched in sweat and tears. I got a bath towel and dried her face and body. Even her panties were soaked. So I helped her out of them. Now wait a minute, don't get any strange ideas. There was nothing funny going on. We always used to bathe together. She was like my little sister.
I know.
I know, I said. Well, anyway, Naoko said she wanted me to hold her. I said it was far too hot for holding, but she said it was the last time we'd be seeing each other, so I held her. Just for a while, with a bath towel between us, so our sweaty bodies wouldn't stick to each other. And when she calmed down, I dried her off again, got her nightdress on her, and put her to bed. She fell sound asleep straight away. Or maybe she was just pretending to sleep. Whatever, she looked so sweet and lovely that night. She had the face of a girl of 13 or 14 who's never had a bit of harm done to her since the day she was born. I saw that look on her face, and I knew I could let myself fall asleep with an easy heart. When I woke at 6 in the morning, she was gone. Her nightdress was there, where she had dropped it. But her clothes and trainers and the torch I always keep by my pillow were missing. I knew immediately that something was wrong. I mean, the very fact that she had taken the torch meant she had left in the dark. I checked her desk just in case, and there was the note, "Please give all my clothes to Reiko." I woke up everybody straight away, and we took different paths to look for her. We searched every inch of the place, from the insides of the dorms to the surrounding woods. It took us 5 hours to find her. She'd even brought her own rope. Reiko sighed and patted the cat. "Want some tea?" I asked.
"Yes, thanks," said Reiko.
I boiled water and brought a pot of tea back to the veranda. Sundown was approaching. The daylight had grown weak, and long shadows of trees stretched to our feet. I sipped my tea and looked at the strangely random garden, with its funny mix of yellow globe flowers and pink azaleas and tall green nandins. So then the ambulance came and took Naoko away, and the police started questioning me. Not that there was much doubt. There was a kind of suicide note, and it had obviously been a suicide. And they took it for granted that suicide was just one of those things that mental patients did. So it was pretty pro forma. As soon as they left, I telegraphed you. "What a sad little funeral it was," I said. "Her family was obviously upset that I knew Naoko had died. I'm sure they didn't want people to know it was suicide. I probably shouldn't even have been there, which made me feel even worse. As soon as I got back, I hit the road."
"Hey, Watanabe, let's go for a walk. We can shop for something to make for dinner, maybe. I'm starving."
"Sure. Is there something you want to eat?"
"Sukiyaki," she said. "I haven't had anything like that for years. I used to dream about sukiyaki, just stuffing myself with beef and green onions and noodles and roasted tofu and greens."
"Sure, we can have that. But I don't have a sukiyaki pan."
"Just leave it to me. I'll borrow one from your landlord."
She ran off to the main house and came back with a good-sized pan and gas cooker and rubber hose.
"Not bad, eh?"
"Not bad." We bought all the ingredients at the little shops in the neighborhood. Beef, eggs, vegetables, tofu. I picked out a fairly decent white wine. I tried to pay, but Reiko insisted on paying for everything. Think how the family would laugh at me if they heard I let my nephew pay for the food, said Reiko. "Besides, I'm carrying a fair amount of cash, so don't worry. I wasn't about to leave the sanatorium broke."
Reiko washed the rice and put it on to boil, while I arranged everything for cooking on the veranda. When everything was ready, Reiko took out her guitar and appeared to be testing it with a slow Bach fugue. On the hard parts, she would purposely slow down or speed up or make it to